Homeless Link is the national membership charity for frontline homelessness services. We work to improve services through research, guidance and learning, and campaign for policy change that will ensure everyone has a place to call home and the support they need to keep it.
In this series of the Going Beyond podcast, we will discuss good practice in how to support individuals experiencing homelessness who have complex health and care needs. The episodes will cover dual diagnosis, physical health needs, hoarding, self-neglect, and brain injury. In each episode, we will speak to a guest who will tell us about their roles and expertise and provide practical tips for frontline staff to deliver good practice. I'm Jo Turner, National Practice Development Project Manager at Homeless Link, and I'll be your host. We hope you enjoy it. In this episode, we speak to Barney Wells, trained mental health social worker who set up the social enterprise EASL, Enabling Assessment Service London. We are also joined by Rachel Brown, trained psychologist working with EASL too. We discuss the reasons behind why someone might self-neglect and think about how and when frontline workers should intervene. So welcome to Barney and Rachel. How are you both today?
Fine, thank you.
I'm good, thank you, Jo.
Good. So thank you so much for being here today to record for the Going Beyond podcast in person too, which is really lovely. So to start us off for the listeners, could you tell us a bit about yourself and the work you do? So Barney, I'll go to you first.
Well, I'm a mental health social worker and I've sort of worked in homelessness really all my career, since the mid-90s, in fact. Initially in hostels, then I qualified, worked in the NHS, mostly in a homeless mental health service. And then in 2011-12, set up a social enterprise called Enabling Assessment Service London. And we provide assessments, advice and training around mental health and homelessness to the homeless sector. And some, not enough, to the mental health sector.
Thank you. Brilliant. Rachel, I'll go to you now.
So my training background is as a psychologist and I work with EASL. Since qualifying, I've always worked in homelessness and mental health, and a lot of my work has been helping people to develop trauma-informed and psychologically informed environments. And that's a lot of the work that I've been doing with EASL recently as well.
Brilliant. Well, thank you both for being here again. So this series of the Going Beyond podcast is all about understanding the complex health and care needs that people experiencing homelessness face. So for this episode, I thought it would be really important to explore self-neglect and homelessness and think about ways frontline workers can support individuals who are self-neglecting. So I wanted to start by asking you both, what does self-neglect look like and what might be the signs that someone is self-neglecting?
I mean, I suppose given my background, I'm most used to thinking about self-neglect in relation to homelessness and especially street homelessness. And I suppose in some circumstances, street homelessness in itself may be a form of self-neglect. It may be a position people are pushed into because of lack of access to housing and resources or something of that sort. But it may be, in effect, something which they... a situation they're in because of the impact potentially of something, albeit trauma or mental health issues or intoxication or something else altogether, mm-hmm. which has made it difficult for them to look after themselves. And I think looking at sort of formal definitions of it, it would tend to refer to sort of an extreme lack of sort of self-care. But I suppose that might be that sort of use of some of those adjectives might be more relevant if it's someone who in many ways is in a relatively safe situation. But for example, looking after their food needs or their hygiene is very extreme. I think if someone is sleeping rough, then very often, you know, given the consequences of that in terms of the risks they face, I think it would be reasonable often to see that as a already an area where there's significant enough concern that we should be actively thinking about it as the possibility of self-neglect.
I think, yeah, just to add to that, what comes to mind when I think about the word self-neglect is around people's basic needs and thinking about their ability to keep themselves safe and feed themselves and get enough sleep and have shelter. And I think sometimes those basic needs are thought about in sort of a hierarchy, that those things need to be present. But I think maybe something that we'll talk about within our conversation is, I think that maybe, you know, the sense of belonging and care and love and that kind of social field is as much a basic need as well, and actually interacts with those more practical basic needs as well. So I think it's important to think about people's relationship with those basic needs and sort of why they're finding it difficult to meet them.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So in terms of kind of responsibilities of frontline workers, if someone was working with an individual and they felt that person may show signs of self-neglect, what are our responsibilities to kind of safeguard that individual?
I think responsibilities to sort of safeguard that person are significant. There may be other reasons why someone, especially someone who is employed, has some responsibilities to engage and think about what's going on, because I suppose it may be that someone's level of self-neglect is impacting other people as well. You know, if in accommodation and fire hazards and some of those sorts of things. So there may be additional reasons. I think in terms of sort of safeguarding, I think we have a responsibility to actively think about where that behaviour is coming from. And I think we have a responsibility to think about if it is only the person themselves who's being impacted by it, is that something that they are being able to make decisions and execute decisions in relation to? And I think it may be that they do, and therefore the sort of responsibility for the frontline workers may in fact be towards being able to think and demonstrate that and articulate that and engage with the person and explore that with the person. And actually, sometimes their responsibility might be to then push back on them to their manager or sort of commissioners and to make a case as to why, in fact, that person, yeah, there are reasons why they might be facing some risk, but we feel that they understand those risks, and there's probably other things which we can sort of offer them which might have a role. And, you know, we'll carry on making contact, but the responsibility is actually about evidencing that not taking dramatic action is reasonable. There might be other situations, though, where actually it comes to a point where you think this person's not necessarily able to make decisions here. There's something else which is interfering with their ability to make decisions. And I'm thinking here about maybe some sort of, well, in the terms of the Mental Capacity Act, mental impairment. So that might be mental illness symptoms, or it might be brain damage or intoxication or something which is really putting them in a position where they're not seen as able to make decisions, in which case then there's a responsibility, a legal responsibility, in fact, in terms of the Mental Capacity Act and sort of safeguarding legislation to sort of act on that and take steps to sort of consider that more fully and maybe seek support to think about what action would be appropriate and proportionate. So, you know, I think it's a sort of two-edged thing, really.
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously it depends on that individual and your kind of assessment on whether they're able to make those decisions for themselves about whether you're going to go through with the kind of those practical interventions and kind of advocate for them and things. But it'd be interesting to hear from you, Rachel, about more of the kind of the psychological interventions or responses to someone that might be self-neglecting.
I guess I was thinking about when Barney was talking around this kind of tension in regard to our responsibility to safeguard and grapple with all of the complexity that Barney was just reflecting on. together with a kind of curious exploration of, as you said, why the person might be in this situation and the kind of our additional duty to protect against not re-harming them or re-traumatising them and that potentially being a safeguarding responsibility as well. And I think for me, to be able to explore sort of what might be happening for somebody, I think quite a useful sort of image is sort of an iceberg. And I guess often we see the behaviour that would be the bit of the ice above the water. But trying to sort of hold in mind some questions that helps us to explore what might be underneath the water. So for me, some of those kind of key questions around what's happened to someone in their life, which I think, you know, is something that we're used to wanting to know about, but sort of a bit more than that to ask ourselves sort of actually how has the person sort of made sense out of those experiences and what's the link between what's happened, how they've made sense out of them, what's the meaning for them and kind of what we might say in trauma-informed language, what they're doing to survive now. So we might look at self-neglect, sort of not meeting their own basic needs as a form of survival. Mm-hmm. So then trying to think, okay, well, you know, from tracking that narrative across time, what ideas might we have about why that person's surviving in that way? Sort of what function might it be serving for them? So some of the key things I think potentially to hold in mind is that whilst it might seem kind of counterintuitive when the system is concerned about someone's safety, but I think, you know, we're as humans, we're kind of programmed to always be working towards trying to keep ourselves safe. That's kind of our basic instinct. So even when it looks like someone's really not looking after themselves, there's probably something within it that is related to them actually trying to re-establish safety for themselves. So, you know, if I was sort of hypothesizing about somebody, thinking about maybe what they've experienced sort of in their younger years as a child, perhaps not having people around them who kept them safe and were able to, maybe because of poverty, provide enough food for them or clothes, and maybe they, you know, have been impacted by racism and discrimination, that, you know, you can really see how someone would sort of learn to potentially hide away and make yourself smaller and silenced. And perhaps I think the key thing within that maybe is to actually really fear other people. You know, we become harmed in relationships and then really want to stay away from people. So even when there are offers of help to kind of try to meet basic needs, that might actually feel so threatening and unbearable that it's better to not have what you need and stay away from people.
Yeah, and the way you say that, it really makes sense as well, why people might behave in that way. You mentioned earlier a little bit about kind of maintaining curiosity in work. I wonder if you could talk a little bit more on that and how that approach to supporting individuals of that curiosity should be like kind of at the heart of everything we do, really. Because I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, kind of fundamental principle. Yeah, I think there's so much of this work that really requires us to bring our whole selves into it, and when we do that, we bring all of our own life experiences and assumptions and biases, which can mean that, you know, we're all also impacted from the strong or dominant social narratives in society as well. So I think whenever we're interfacing in relationship with any, something is generated within us, and being able to sort of be aware enough of ourselves to be curious about, you know, the response in our own minds, our own thoughts, our sensations in our own body, so that we can perhaps notice our instincts or our kind of patterns that we fall into, because that's what we've been taught over time, and to actually say, okay, I noticed that, but actually, you know, I wonder what might be uniquely going on for this person, and to be able to perhaps pause and ask some of those questions about what's happened to you, to be able to reflect with colleagues it's always amazing how sort of rich it is when you hear from different people, you know, have maybe had similar interactions with the same person, the different things that they notice just because of our, all of our unique sort of identity characteristics. So I think there's something about curiosity which is really grounding and rebalancing and can help us sort of return to an open-mindedness and a kind of a approach which helps us to hold lots of different ways of understanding.
No, absolutely. And I think the sort of curiosity is absolutely about understanding what's making sense for that person and how they're sort of doing that. But I think it's maintaining in parallel to that, for example, so curiosity about risk and acuity of risk. And I think, you know, the sort of flip side of that, I think sort of, I think especially people who are in a position of extreme powerlessness, I think there is a danger of identities and explanations and narratives being projected upon that person. And sometimes they don't have very much to do with the person themselves. It's more to do with maybe something which is to do with the person who's doing that sort of projecting. And so I suppose, you know, I have had experiences over the years where someone's who's in a position of severe self-neglect and sometimes emotional distress and experiencing tormenting delusions and other things. And I've heard from professionals even who've had contact about how this person's a great British eccentric or somehow they're sort of, you know, an example to all of us of putting one up against the system or whatever, where actually not very much engagement might reveal that person's in that position because they're very scared of things which appear linked to a psychotic illness, for example. And so there's it goes the other way. And I suppose the other thing with the sort of curiosity is needing to keep those things going and to be quite active in your thinking on an ongoing basis and thinking, for example, about risk in a very sort of contextualized way. So, you know, absolutely, if someone is sort of sleeping out and it's May and they appear maybe somehow disorientated and it's difficult to work out what's going on, then everything points towards making time and finding ways and finding strategies to sort of spend time with that person and engage what's going on. You know, if they're shivering with cold and it's February and they've got no shoes on, you know, the notwithstanding what Rachel was saying about needing to take into account the impact of an intervention which might, in the very short term, might take control over them, take control away from them, there might be a situation where you need to actively think about, hang on, is leaving this person in this situation okay? Or do we actually need to think about whether, you know, for their own immediate safety, action needs to be taken? So it's sort of keeping alive to that and not sort of trying to reach a tidy conclusion and leaving it there. You know, it's thinking in quite a dynamic way about these different balances.
I don't know what you think, Barney, but I wonder whether even in that moment where sometimes action has to be taken, sort of anchoring into the curiosity, if you like, also supports the how that happens as well, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And how that happens, you know, it shouldn't be a matter of sort of a button being pressed and then some sequence of actions. A whole process of that ought to be informed by a sort of a kind thoughtfulness about what that person might be experiencing in the moment, as well as everything else. And I don't know, I mean, whether it's timely. I mean, just sort of thinking about some sort of examples, and these are sort of two sort of situations I can think of, which are sort of, you know, not really based on one person, but, you know, I can remember, you know, working with someone for nearly a decade with whom there were concerns about their level of apparent self-neglect and the really quite sort of extreme sort of weather they were leaving themselves out in and the very sort of very narrow diet and, you know, not someone engaging with around their physical health and there being lots of concerns during that period and a lot of engagement and it never feeling appropriate in his instance to take any power away from him. But during that time, there was a need to revisit that decision and to spend more time with him and to support, you know, there needed to be really good quality of work and communication between the outreach team and mental health professionals, trying to sort of think what was sort of going on. And it could have really easily disintegrated into a situation where one organisation denigrated the other and sort of blamed them for not providing a solution, but it didn't. And it was unusual in that. And actually, ultimately, that person took a decision to come inside and sort of, you know, on and when he did so, was saying, well, you can talk to the outreach team for background information. And that was great. But I think it was appropriate as well for that level of thought to go into working with him through that time because actually he was putting himself in a very extreme position and there were some reasons to think, actively think about whether he had capacity to make that decision. So, you know, that would be a sort of one example. But I can think of other situations where actually because of the level of immediacy of risk and maybe not a huge amount, but some evidence of mental disorder, it did feel appropriate to actually think in terms of stepping in and, you know, with involving the right professionals in terms of those statutory assessments, someone being detained under the Mental Health Act and it, you know, and that being, I think, the right thing. And I've had experiences where someone who for whom that's happened to has been able to say afterwards, I'm glad that happened. You know, and clearly those are two quite sort of tidy scenarios and sometimes it's going to be messier in the middle. But I think there's something which is beholden on services and people working to sort of be ready to accept the complexity of this work and to not feel harried to sort of come up with a binary decision one way or the other, or if a decision's made, okay, we don't think it's appropriate to do this now, for that to be revisited and to different strategies and thought and time spent in a different way in between those times.
Yeah, I think before when we spoke, you said that there's that tension between self-determination and intervention. And I think, Rachel, you mentioned earlier about kind of the need for us to weigh up the immediate risk versus potential re-traumatisation as well. And I think often as like frontline workers, maybe new to the sector, you might see something and immediately want to kind of take action and say, right, you know, we're contacting adult social care, we're doing this, and not actually kind of approaching it with that kind of curiosity and thinking what is going on for that individual. And I think that's a real key thing that frontline workers should really be considering, not just sort of all guns blazing. It's hang on, what's going on that individual is kind of, you know, not looking after their basic needs in this certain way. I think that's something that you guys have really, really taught me already. And I think it's, yeah, really important.
It just listening to you sort of summarise there, it makes me think, you know, that it's really important that staff have support to sort of think through this complexity, because I really don't think it's easy. It's a lot to bear, actually, and a lot to ask. And I think we all need each other to provide sort of thinking spaces so that these things can be grappled with and we can hold that curious, reflective stance and work it through together, because it's no one person's sort of responsibility, is it, to hold those kind of decision-making needs, if you like. So yeah, I think obviously part of a trauma-informed, psychologically informed approach is to think about those systems of support around people.
Absolutely. And I think ideally as well, trying to support the wider system to be sort of trauma-informed and able to hold that complexity. Because I think, you know, actually it was something which came out recent at the Homeless Link conference, actually. But sort of there's something about things like KPIs and monitoring information and sort of figures and trying to demonstrate outcomes in ways which don't leave space for the complexity of the work to be sort of taken on board. And I think it's sort of having a space, having a system where those different sort of different agendas are sort of understood, but the fact that it's going to be a complicated process, it's going to involve different ways of understanding, different rights for the individual, different rights for the society to be balanced, and you know, it needs to be given opportunity for those, that complexity to be held, and not, it's not okay for that individual worker to feel that they're holding it on their own. They ought to be supported by their organization, they ought to be supported by support which might help them in their understanding of what's going on, but there's something about the wider system as well being ready to get involved and acknowledge that things aren't straightforward always.
Yeah, I think, like you said, with the KPIs, often it's so sort of strict, it's such a strict measurement, like X many people have, you know, registered for the doctor, or, you know, have now accessed mental health support. And like you said, it doesn't allow for that reflection time and that maintaining curiosity and allowing that person to kind of think about what they might need or actually acknowledge that maybe they need support. And I think KPIs really don't reflect that a journey is very kind of, yeah, it's not linear. And actually there could be so much progress going on with that individual that isn't captured within that monitoring report. But it's about, yeah, like you said, the wider system of, we need to make sure that this not just about the numbers.
No, and I've been, you know, and things like a street count is a street count, and it is what it is, and it sort of demonstrates something. But yeah, what is the story in each of those people's own life and scenario, and sort of what is it appropriate for the sort of local authority and commission sort of services to be not doing or doing? And but equally, I've been in situations where, you know, an outreach or a team or a sort of a homeless lead in a local authority saying, well, no, they were seen by the mental health services and they've got capacity. So now we're going to go down this route and or something of that sort. And actually, again, that's not necessarily a helpful way of sort of simplifying things either, because it might be, yes, at particular point of time, it appeared that someone had capacity, things might shift for them, you know, there might be other ways sort of going on and other things. And I suppose that's the other thing which we haven't said, which is important to say. It is also about resources, you know, and it isn't just about you know, the sort of approach and understanding. Mm-hmm. And actually, if people are made an offer which is more acceptable to them, which manages to sort of be less frightening for them, which leaves them feeling more able, where they're supported through that process by someone they've got a relationship of trust with, then that's always going to be better. And I think some of the worst situations I've been involved in this work is when there are worries, genuine concerns about someone's capacity, for example, but you're also acutely aware that maybe because of limited entitlements or something, the options which are available to them are pretty rubbish. And you sort of, you know, actually what should be happening is something tailored to that person's needs might resolve everything for that person and everything else. But your system is pushing people into a situation where a more dramatic choice needs to be made than is necessary.
Yeah, I think I was, you know, I was just thinking as we were talking generally that whilst we've got this responsibility to safeguard and uphold safety primarily. You know, I think these opportunities where we meet people sort of, you know, really, really struggling are also opportunities to do something different as well. Like to you know, I think Karen Treisman talks about it as sort of every interaction is an intervention, you know, like each time we meet with someone, it really matters. And I think, you know, that question of like, what could we do to make this? I mean, I really hear what Barney was saying about the resources and the capacity to sort of make tailored interventions. But what can we do to make this safer for this person? Like, if we do know, or we can hypothesize about what's happened to them in their life that they're struggling with, like, what can we do that is one step better than now to make this relationship or this environment feel safer, that perhaps then makes a difference to, you know, their internal sense of self and worth that then might lead to them doing something different. So yeah, I think there definitely are things we can do even within sort of, you know, the context of limited resources, because we still have ourselves as humans, and you know, we can think about some of those key anchors really of creating these positive relationships with people. I don't know if it's helpful for me to say maybe some of those. You know, I think some of them are so basic, maybe we don't always sort of appreciate what people are already doing, or perhaps we get distracted away because of some of the systemic challenges that Barney's been speaking to. But I think trying to meet with somebody in a kind of a generous way, if you like, where we turn up sort of grounded and regulated and settled ourselves. And some of the basic things of just actually really, really listening, really actively listening, I don't think we celebrate enough, like actually really being really curious about what someone has to say and explain, I think can be really healing. And I think there's some simple things maybe as well about, you know, within the context of helping people re-establish safety, there's something important about control, I think, as well, and choice, you know, some of the anchors of the trauma-informed approach. But I think sometimes we can end up giving people too much choice, or we can use too many words. So actually being quite kind of clear about why we're there, sort of what the task is or what the choices are, I think can be really helpful. And some of the other basic things of doing what you're saying you're going to do, coming at the time that you're saying you're going to come, you know, if someone asks you to back off, to back off. And, you know, one of the anchors of trauma-informed approach, which I think is really important in context of self-neglect as well, is to think about people's strengths and resources where possible. You know, even if I think it's hard for them to conjure that or evoke that within themselves, for staff to be able to find that hope within themselves and sort of almost even imagine it for the person, I think as well.
Yeah, absolutely. That's so useful. Thank you, Rachel.
And one final thing I wanted to say, I mean, based really on what Rachel was saying about the importance of the sort of relationship often, or the power of potential power of the relationship of the worker, the homeless worker with the person who is experiencing homeless, is something about them actually valuing that themselves, that's the worker, and then valuing their understanding of that person's situation, and actually their understanding as to why they might be more concerned or less concerned about the risks faced by that person. Because it may well be there are other people in the system who have more power than them, a mental health worker or something else, but they ought to take on board what the homeless sector worker is saying. Mm-hmm. If it's grounded, especially in sort of good practice and a proper understanding of the person and their situation, that ought to account for a lot when any decision's made.
Mm-hmm. I think that's all we've got time for. But thank you both so much for coming and speaking with me today. It's been really useful to understand the reasons behind why someone might self-neglect and think about how and when workers should intervene. But yes, thank you so much, Barney and Rachel, for your time.
Thanks for listening. To keep up to date with the latest goings on at Homeless Link, please follow us on Twitter at Homeless Link. If you're interested in training and development opportunities for yourself, your team, or your organisation, get in touch by emailing training@homelesslink.org.uk. We have a range of courses that help staff and organisations develop the skills needed to tackle current issues and improve services.